Hello, welcome to today's Case Study Museum interview, one of eight recorded for the AMM Essential Questions Program series. Over the course of this series, we're finding out how museums are faring today, 3 years after the start of the pandemic and civic unrest following George Floyd's murder. We will be chatting with eight different museums across the Midwest about what they've learned about themselves and their audiences, what changes they made that have stuck, and what new models or approaches they've tried. These interviews are talk show style, featuring guest moderators. They are pre-recorded so that you can listen to them when it's convenient. And listeners will have the opportunity to ask questions of our museum panelists during live Q&A sessions this spring. So stay tuned for more. Today's feature museum is the Bakken Museum in Minneapolis, Minnesota. And today's interviewer is Michelle Moon, an independent consultant and content developer, principal of Saltworks Interpretive Consulting. And with that, I'll hand it over to Michelle.
Thank you so much, Charity, and to AMM for hosting this set of really important conversations and capturing some of what is going on in the moment to help our museums navigate this time where there is such a blank roadmap ahead for us. And I really appreciate being joined today by our staff from the Bakken Museum in Minneapolis. I'd love to begin with some introductions so we can meet the folks who are joining us today. And I'll first invite Alyssa to introduce herself and then pass the mic to her colleagues that are with us this morning.
Thanks, Michelle. And it's great to be with you. My name's Alyssa Light. I use she, her pronouns, and I have the privilege and honor of being the relatively new president and CEO of the Bakken Museum. And I'll pass it to Joe.
Thanks, Alyssa. Thanks, Michelle, and thanks, AMM. My name is Joe Imholt. I am the executive vice president here at the Bakken Museum. Over to Alex.
Thanks, Joe. My name is Alex Askew. I am the director of development here at the Bakken.
Wonderful. We really appreciate all of your time today to share your practice. I'm new to the Bakken Museum. I've never visited, but I have really enjoyed diving into your resources that you've presented online and really appreciating the vision of your values in action. You've shared your values as part of this inquiry, your institutional values of creativity, adaptability, collaboration, and equity. And we're going to, I think, see how those weave into your practice today as we go on with this conversation. It's a small to mid-sized museum based around a historic mansion in Minneapolis, and you really focus on STEM, but with a wonderful integration of humanities and creativity. So we already see that value. So I encourage everyone watching to spend time with your resources, and if you can visit. An amazing place. It's going to be at the top of my list. So currently you are running about a $2.6 million budget, about 25 full-time staff, 9 part-time staff, and your annual visitation is around 28,000. So that helps us get a sense of your operation. But to start things off, you have the opportunity today to talk a bit about what this last few years has been like. And Alyssa, with you coming in fairly recently, and Joe and Alex also not being there too long pre-pandemic, you've endured a tremendous amount of change in your tenure. So I'd like to open by asking, what do you feel like you've learned over the last few years? And, you know, you might be said to have a new normal, but in fact, perhaps this adaptability and change has just been your normal since that has characterized your time so far. So I think I'll begin by asking Joe to respond, and we'll do a round robin and hear a little bit from everybody about what you've learned from these last few years of dynamic change.
Yeah, thanks, Michelle. I think one of the things that has been most important, or one of the things I've learned to lean the most on the last few years is flexibility. The importance of having a plan, but also the importance of being able to shift away from that plan and to be able to do something completely different or slightly different based on the needs of the staff. And I think an example of that was we've really worked our way through how we're working from home versus working here at the building. And one of the things that we've encountered here is that there's just actually a desire for folks to be on site. And so we started with having one day a week as a required time at the museum. But staff feedback was, what's happening is all our meetings are happening on those days. And we'd like there to be more required days on site. And so we're in a 3-day a week model where 2 days are set, but 1 day is up to the employee's choice for folks who can work from home. But that's really being flexible and listening to feedback and not being driven entirely by what the external world is saying should be done, but listening to what the staff here want to see done. Curious to see what others would say.
Yes, let's pass the baton over to Alex.
Yeah, thanks. When I think of this question, I think there was a shift. You know, 2018 and 2019, we were doing so much for our visitors, and we were, you know, we kind of had the culture internally of, you know, we go hard and we pull out all the stops and we just kind of work ourselves to the bone to create a great visitor experience. And I think one of the things that we picked up over the pandemic was that it's okay to work on ourselves as well. You know, we can do our own internal professional development. We can build a culture that is more than just, you know, wearing ourselves thin for the experience of our guests. And we know that that in turn helps the visitor experience of when we take care of ourselves, when we build a really intentional internal climate, when we provide each other opportunities for further engagement or for development, it translates into a really great experience for the guests. But that doesn't mean we're, you know, working ourselves to the bone every week, overworking ourselves in the process of doing it. So I think just understanding that balance a little bit more intentionally is something that we picked up during these last couple of years.
That is such an interesting observation, Alex. And I think the there's so much in our field that has created that expectation to overwork and perhaps even step into the realm of burnout on the principle that the harder we work, the better it will be for visitors. And I think many of us have discovered that coming to the end of that energy output ability has meant that we rethink how that works, and that in fact, resourcing our employees and ourselves better can turn into a better experience for visitors. Alyssa, I would love to hear your thoughts on that too. You shared with us earlier that you've come into this museum from the world of the helping professions and from youth development and LGBTQ development. So there's some human-centered practice that you've been familiar with. How do you see that playing into the learning you're doing in the museum?
Yes. Yeah. Thanks, Michelle. And gosh, I love what Joe and Alex shared. And as they were speaking, I was thinking about just my experience thus far, 5 months in, really witnessing how critical the relationships between staff and also in our community and with our audience is. And a part of, I think, what we've been practicing through these, you know, years of the pandemic is rooting into the kind of time and commitment it takes to build relationships with each other and deepen the relationships in our community so that we can show up in mutually supportive ways. Coming from healthcare, I really recognize that it's not just frontline kind of helping professions that are deeply impacted by things like vicarious trauma or the reverberating impact of the lasting kind of anxiety we hold through this stage of the pandemic. And we have to be really conscientious of a museum space and an education space working with young people and how we really have an opportunity to practice what we preach, to slow it down, to deepen the relationships and really convey to our audiences and our young people and each other that care and mutual support is something not only we value, but it's critical to our ongoing vitality as an organization.
Indeed, this theme is one that I see rising to the surface across the profession. And I just want to mention, if you have received the Museum Magazine this month, there is a whole article about workplace experience and how to do that kind of mutual support and rethink the way we interact on a museum staff. I wonder if you could all speak to elements of the operation that may have changed as you rethink these organizational values. Is there anything that you've let go of? Is there any aspect of operation that you've changed? Joe spoke to really an authentic self-interrogation of what you want from the on-site versus homework experience and not importing a cookie cutter model from what others seem to be doing, which I think is one thing, one great example of something that you've practiced adaptability with. You've let go the notion that there needs to be a 5-day work week with everyone on site at the same time and built in a lot of flexibility. So I see that as one possible answer. But are there other things you've let go or discovered or instituted as part of all of this internal examination? And I'll leave that open for anyone who has a thought.
I can jump in the deep end here. I'll speak from a fundraising perspective because I think there's some interesting examples that we can pull out here. But you know, it just kind of coincidentally lined up this way. Over the course of the pandemic, over the past 2.5 years or so, we've almost 3 years now, we've been having some really focused internal conversations on our fundraising team around different models of philanthropy. And so, you know, the main buzzwords we hear now to describe some of these models are donor-centric or community-centric fundraising. And for those interested, I really encourage you to research some of that because it's quite fascinating, the different practices. But the more that we interrogated those, and I think of them as two separate models, the donor-centric and the community-centric, when we interrogated those with a lens of looking at, you know, the term we use is white supremacy culture and how that pops up in organizations, and using those two models and then that white supremacy culture, there's some tools around that to understand what those values look like in a workplace. It's really kind of shown that some of the previous practices we had with donor engagement weren't what we were attempting to cultivate. You know, they didn't live into the values that we had reaffirmed to ourselves. And so, you know, for example, we had the opportunity to really rework all of our fundraising practices. So, you know, we had an event in 2018 that we were looking to model in the future. And then we made some really significant tweaks to it to make sure that it was living into some of those values. And it was putting the community first in the work that we were doing. There are a number of examples with language around our appeals, the way we talk to donors, the way we invite them into the work that are just different now because of that interrogation that we've been able to have internally. So using, you know, that time and the impetus that we had, especially in the Twin Cities, to rethink what does white supremacy culture look like in a workplace, and that really focused attitude of interrogation, we were able to change a lot of our internal fundraising practices in particular.
Really interesting to hear how those movements are working their way into your practice. I know before we began this discussion, Joe shared a little bit about how partnerships and the idea of a visitor being someone that walks through your doors is one of the other things you've been willing to rethink. And Joe, I wonder if you could talk a little bit about that.
Sure. So a couple of things. First is one of the great things that pre-existed, the three of us who are on this call, that the Bakken Museum did a long time ago, was made a huge commitment to delivering our programs outside of our walls. And so pre-pandemic, we actually reached more students off-site than we did on-site. And I know that's it's a thing that many museums are working towards. And to land at an organization that had already achieved that had really kind of recognized the limitations of our site in terms of location and overall size and that sort of thing, and really pushing out not just to the, you know, St. Paul and Minneapolis public school districts, but to rural communities all over the state. Was really impressive and was really very exciting. It continues to be a really exciting thing to be a part of, and is a great way for us to be able to continue to deliver our programming, you know, and to think about our programming differently. And I think the other thing was that we work on partnerships with local theaters and other arts organizations during the pandemic, during the shutdown periods of the pandemic, I should say. So for example, we have this giant green roof that's a great space for theaters to use as performance space. And knowing that theaters were looking for places to have a performance, that indoors wasn't an option, we opened up our theater space and had an entire summer series of outdoor performances. And some things have stuck around since then. We've maintained a relationship with Open Eye Theater. They now perform two performances here regularly on an annual basis. We've continued our partnership with an organization called The Show, which is an art gallery or a nonprofit art organization that focuses on artists with disabilities. So really being able to continue those partnerships moving forward has been really helpful and beneficial for us as well.
Alyssa, I'm curious about how you'd answer this question as someone for whom the museum traditions might be the newer aspect. Are there things that you've encouraged the team to let go? Are there practices you have brought in to be discovered? How have you negotiated these kinds of changes since your arrival?
Yeah, it's a great question. In vulnerability, one of the things that I really needed to practice entering into this field and exiting from healthcare was giving myself space and time to heal and actually slow down and not act with so much urgency or be searching for the crisis. So when you ask that, actually the reflection for me is, what did I need to let go of and sort of turn towards? And the team has been gracious and really mentors to me in navigating entering a new sector and thinking about, what can connect from this through line of a healing and healthcare space, and then a third space as a museum and really a joy generator as a, field trip and STEM education experience, and see the through line, but let go of some of the kind of extra energy around it coming from healthcare. And one other reflection I have is just that I think we're all in mutual support of helping us navigate what can we kind of continue to let go of as we move into another stage of the pandemic, and continue to just ask each other the questions of, what lessons have we learned that we want to carry forward, and what experiences have we had that we really need to release and let go of? So it's almost like a key lesson is, it's an ongoing practice and it's an ongoing kind of mutual exercise for us as an institution to support that reflective space and time. I don't think that's ever going to end. And actually, I don't think we should let it.
I so appreciate that you are speaking about vulnerability. And I feel that is another value that we are seeing more people talk about across the field and integrating into our work, because we are truly in a time no one has experienced this before in our era. We are all creating, responding, evaluating what's happening, and no one can come with a package of ready answers. We have tools, we have options and experience, and we have emerging models like the things Alex was talking about, but this ongoing kind of creativity, reflection, and adaptability seems so important to maintain the health of our working communities and the communities that we're serving and partnering with. So I want to transition from that perfect segue to talk about your efforts to create an inclusive and an equitable workplace. You mentioned that this is one of your strategic pillars. So this is embedded at the highest level of structure that you've given your organization. For those who aren't familiar with your organization, can you walk us through where that intentional focus got started? I'm sure, like many museums, these things have been on your mind for a long time, but when did you come together around the idea that this would be a priority? And I'm not sure who's able to speak to that. Let's start with Joe.
Thanks, Michelle. I think so. It's interesting for me because one of the charges I had when I arrived at the Bakken was to have some DEI focus. I will say that one of the things that was really very helpful in that was that this the energy and the enthusiasm for that was very, very present. And I think what was mostly needed was just someone willing to to own the potential failure really to help move it forward in that way. There was so much already in place and thoughts in underway. You know, Alex already talked about, you know, like the thinking around community centric fundraising and also all that sort of thing. So like I said, the ground was really very fertile. It's a personal value of many of the folks here. So it wasn't a heavy lift. It's just some of the, some of the broader understandings that are just coming to understanding that, you know, we're all at different places in our learning. We're going to be constantly moving too fast for some people and too slow for others. You know, there's just these moments of like, we're never going to be perfect. And trying for perfection is actually not the outcome that we should be aiming for. So it's kind of circling around those things, because I think particularly for a majority white organization like ours, there can be a lot of fear around failure and a lot of intention around perfectionism that can really hamper actual movement. And so it's the energy around let's think more about moving forward than where we're than a final destination and really just focus on that. And like I said, the energy here around that has been tremendous and really fun to work with. I don't know, Alex, I'd love to hear your perspective on that.
Yeah, I think that's a great summary. I think just, you know, on the ground, what happened since Joe kind of took up the leadership on this topic is that we began having a really specific staff curriculum. And so at all of our monthly staff meetings, we had time taken out in order to do some key conversations in small groups and larger groups. We had, you know, external work that was to be done in between those meetings. We were encouraged within our own teams to dig into some of these issues and use tools like understanding white supremacy culture, looking at some of the ways that we prioritize work. The one watershed moment was the creation of a DEAI committee underneath our personnel committee of the board, which involves staff and board members. And I won't say too much about it because I think Joe can speak to it a lot more eloquently than I can. But there have been a number of moments in which our institutional commitment to this work has really solidified. And I think the creation of that committee was one of them. I think another point that I'll introduce now, and we can talk about a little bit later, is that committee then created a DEAI theory of change for the organization, which was created just before our strategic planning process happened. And so the strategic planning process was really able to incorporate that theory of change into the work that they did. And then we also had a really cool example of a staff-driven task force, which was around LGBTQ plus workplace inclusion. And the example of a task force really utilizing resources to make some recommendations to our senior leadership here at the organization. So there have been, feet on the ground. There have been a number of institutional points where we've really deepened our roots into this work in really permanent, substantial ways. But I agree, it all kind of started when someone in high leadership, Joe in this instance, was really able to own and push this process and kind of, I like what you said about failure, because, you know, when you start this work, you don't really know where it's going to go despite, you know, your best intentions. And when you create a theory of change, which is one of the first things we did, it ends up into kind of vague territory when we think about, well, what is the overall goal or impact that we want to have on our much larger community? So that's, I think, where I'll leave it. Happy to dive into any of those specific elements at any point.
I'm inspired by the way you're speaking about some of the tools you've reached out beyond the museum world to engage. The idea of theory of change is one that I still see museums coming to as a new concept and something I think is very important for us to embrace. Your use of the many tools there are to do the DEAI self-examination of white supremacy culture, or white fragility, understanding the principles of inclusion, and community-centric fundraising. I really, really see you as curious, again, embodying one of your values of curiosity and bringing in tools that can help you grow and evolve the practice. Since you mentioned your board and having a DEI committee that linked board and staff, I wonder if Joe and Alyssa can talk about your board's investment in this work. I know this is a challenge for many museums who aren't sure how supportive their board will be or how knowledgeable their board is on these topics. Can you talk to us about the nature of your board? How did they become engaged and become such strong supporters and involved players, it sounds like, in this process?
Do you want to go first, Alyssa?
Sure. I can speak to my experience thus far. And Joe, I think the history piece is a place where, you know, we really need your expertise and lens. From my perspective, again, having joined the organization about 5 months ago, one of the things demonstrated to me was through the recruitment and interview process, it became clear to me that the board understood how critical it was to the organization and actually to the staff that the board center DEAI in their president and CEO search and hiring process. So from the questions I was asked to the opportunity to review the theory of change and the strategic plan and really kind of better understand to the degree I was able in that process, what the commitment was of the organization to centering DEAI in everything we did, that articulated to me that there was board level commitment to integrating DEAI in the entire mission of the organization. From my perspective, I think the opportunity now going forward is to continue to identify the ways in which the board's structure, both the committees, the board assessment process, the recruitment process, and the larger board meetings can center DEAI conversations in a way that more fully connect to where the staff are. And that's a challenge for all boards, I think, in part just given the limitations of time and sometimes, you know, the procedural and fiduciary responsibilities can feel like they're in conflict to centering DEAI. And I think where the true opportunity is in fact, they're part and parcel. They're one and the same. There's a complete through line. And I hope that that frame for this next chapter of our work can really bring kind of the whole circle to the perspective rather than perhaps DEAI as a standalone pillar. And I think the appetite is there, the curiosity is there, the eagerness is there, and now we need to kind of take it to the next level.
Yeah, the only thing I'd add is that coming in, one of the things that was really great was that the board was open. I think that there's a risk, you know, with boards that they could be resistant or, you know, it could be, it has to be done this particular way because that's how it was done in my organization. But they were pretty open to listening to what the staff wanted and willing to learn along with us. And so I think that's that was the gift of being able to have that board support in that way.
It's so great that the board, as you've called out, Alyssa, is embracing that opportunity to be transformative in its own thinking about the practices and traditions of being part of a board and to reimagine that along with the staff. So I wish you continued good progress on that. Again, something really important as a model for others. Part of this work, your DEAI work, has been to look at your salary structure. And I know this is something that is on the minds of many viewers of this conversation. And one of the great challenges of our field is that longstanding assumption that museum work will pay less than similar work in adjacent fields, or that certain categories of museum work will, by tradition, pay less well, compensate less well, and also the reality that many of the staff members in museums are experiencing gaps in pay equity, as in other fields, due to race, gender, their educational background, and so forth. So these are really salient issues for every museum. And the Bakken Museum has taken this on, and I think done some very carefully structured work and deep analysis and even additional financial planning and fundraising to make sure this can happen. And I would love for our listeners to hear more about that process And Joe, you've written about this for AAM's website, The Future of Museums. And maybe you could begin by telling us about, you know, some of your personal experience and that personal motivation at looking at, you know, why are things the way they are? And what latitude do we have to rethink the structure of museum compensation in a way that does center our staff and address these equity concerns?
Yeah, sure. It is something I find very interesting. I think it's also interesting to me that, you know, as a field, museums are not a monolith, and how art museums are funded is so different from how history museums are funded, just so different from science museums are funded, and how different, you know, from county historical society. And how important those funding mechanisms and the location of the museum, the size of the museum, all those things play a role in terms of like the culture around salary, philosophies around salary, all that sort of thing. So I think all of that is really interesting. And I think it's one of the challenges in our industry is we talk about salary is that we all kind of tend to gravitate to the art museum model because they're the largest group in our category, and that we're all not structured like art museums or have salary structures like art museum, which is one of the interesting challenges. For me, it was a charge that the organization had was to try to do our best to get our salaries in line with the industry and to make sure that there wasn't inequities that were due to race or gender. And we hadn't done a salary audit that I could see at the beginning of the process. And so we started by doing a salary audit. And one of the things that we learned from that was that we were good in terms of a gender and race in terms of salary equity. So somebody at some point had done some work to ensure that. So that was great. As part of the process, one of the staff here pushed back pretty hard on me on, and this was a great example of, you know, making sure to check your own assumptions and your own biases and so forth, was, you know, her argument was, you know, yes, it's true that, you know, education staff are paid less across the industry, but is that right? Just because it's true, does that mean that make it okay? And I grew up in the frontline, you know, operations education side of the thing. I had spent some time in exhibits and other areas, but, you know, my salary was rooted to where I started as full-time. And so I was traditionally always behind my peers in terms of earning. And it's just kind of one of those deals where you live with it for so long and it gets explained to you so many times that you're just like, oh, okay, like that's just how it is. And so then when you're in a leadership role, you just perpetuate that because that's how you've been kind of indoctrinated. And so I'm really grateful for having, you know, that's one of the great things about the Bakken is that they're, you know, folks are willing to challenge and to push back and do so in a constructive way. And, you know, I was challenged and she was completely right. And so that was one of the things that we worked really hard is to bring, you know, so education staff are paid, you know, if you're at a manager level, director level in education, you're paid at the same kind of tier as your colleagues in marketing or in exhibits and so forth. Which is not common in our field. And then the other thing was to make sure that we were, you know, where we sat in terms of industry salary. So we knew we couldn't afford to lead. We couldn't afford to be, you know, in the 90th percentile, but we knew we didn't want to tail. We didn't want to be at the bottom end. So we chose the 50th percentile to be, and then we tried to choose multiple sources to draw our salary data from so that one low salary wouldn't bring somebody down. So that by averaging, we hopefully bring everybody up to a good number. I don't know, that one of the things I'll say is that it's a, you know, there isn't a manual that sits out there that says this is the perfect way to do salary. This is, or here's the way to do it the most equitably, period, definitively. And so it's still an ongoing conversation that we're having. We're actually already gearing up for the next process and being really deliberate about thinking through, you know, what things did staff have challenges with? Are we being equitable in these processes that we've claimed are? Are they truly? Are there more equitable ways of doing it? And then just holding the fact that no matter what we do, it's probably not going to be perfect. It's not going to be exactly right because there isn't an exactly right. and knowing that helps quite a bit in terms of what you're thinking and your planning and how you're communicating. So I don't know, Alex was somebody who lived quite a bit through this. So your perspective, I think, would be really, really, really great as well, because it's not just the person who did, but the person who was done too.
Yeah, I can just chime in with a couple thoughts here. I think one is that, you know, like Joe had said, we hadn't had a real centralized structure in hiring prior to this work being done. So what you had happen was that different departments were offering salaries that, you know, they were either determining through their own budget constraints or through their own market pressures. And so what you ended up is, you know, different departments being able and offering different values to the same level of work. Like Joe was saying, if you're a manager, no matter where you are in the organization, let's at least, you know, put you on some sort of a level playing field. And so when this work was taken on, it was really encouraging because, you know, as a development professional, I was paid on the higher end of the spread of salaries. And that's just due to the market pressures of hiring a development professional. And so to know that it was being deliberately thought about all together made me feel a lot better because it made me, you know, much more confident that we are going to be moving towards a more equitable structure. Yeah, maybe I'll leave it at that. That sounds great.
I do have a follow-up for you, Alex, but I'm interested just to call out a few points from the things that both of you have just said. Hearing again about openness to change and understanding that the processes are iterative and never finished, never complete. And secondly, that you, once again, responding to your value of uniqueness and the kind of authenticity and truthfulness to who your museum is, comes in to kind of overpower some of those traditions and market pressures to say, this is who we are and what we choose to do and offer. And there's an honesty and a value in that that I think can be perceived by employees as, you know, another benefit, another thing to admire in the work of the museum. So I think that assumption is very common that we respond to the pressures of what a marketing executive would be paid in another sector rather than what's true for us and right for us. So again, I really appreciate that idea of know thyself that you're living out. But my question for you, Alex, is as one of the people, probably the lead person who needs to think about how to market this to donors, how do you say to donors, we'd like to spend more on our staff, not on our more visitors, more exhibits, more programs. We often hear that critique of too much overhead, too much employee, you know, comforts or amenities. So you're the one who needs to argue to people and to make the case that investing in humans and their needs and their satisfaction at work is going to yield value in the long run. So how do you find yourself doing that? And do you find donors are more receptive to this idea today?
Yeah, that's a great question. I don't think it's come up, you know, quite honestly in individual donor conversations as much. I think where it's really made an impact in the work that I do is the way that we think about project related grants nowadays, where, you know, we are much more intentional now about building in specific overhead and really justifying that overhead into the grant proposal itself. Because, you know, if we're proposing to do a program and it relies on the building being open and cleanup happening and staff working hours that they can't be doing other things for, you know, we need to compensate the organization for the totality of that work. And I feel much more justified in arguing for that now in a grant proposal than I did 4 years ago when I started at the Bakken. And I think part of that is, you know, we've in Minnesota, especially, we have a really strong nonprofit sector. And we have donors, both institutional and individual, that are involved with nonprofits. And we've had some really public conversations around what is overhead and what especially with the twin kind of situations of the pandemic happening and, you know, many arts and cultural, especially, but many nonprofits kind of finding themselves without their normal playbook. And then obviously the murder of George Floyd and really understanding what role does the nonprofit sector play in our community. And I think you have donors, both institutional and individual, who are much more open and receptive to hearing you know, what is the totality of your constraints? Museums, I think, have for the full outsider have this image of, oh, it's all earned income. Oh, yeah, you charge me when I go in. You charge me for a membership. Of course, you're paying your bills. It's easy. You just have people come in. When we know, you know, in reality, that's a very, very small percentage of our income stream. And so it's just we've had the opportunity to share that message with the public a number of times. And I think it's made those conversations a lot easier. But as a really short answer, yes, I've gotten much more direct about advocating for what we truly need in order to support our staff. And I think, Alyssa, you might have some really great things to say here, especially when talking to our board about, you know, during these hard years, we've increased the expenses that have gone to salary because of the work that Joe and the team did and this salary audit process.
Yeah, wow. And Alex, just clapping for your response. Great, great, great response. I love how you framed that up. And I do think, you know, looking ahead, one of the opportunities is to continue to bust out of a scarcity mentality. And that absolutely involves working with the board to kind of think strategically and long-term about what are the like long-term investments to deepen the opportunities in front of us, and what does that look like, and what's the short-term, you know, risk we're willing to take on to get to that longer, farther out place of abundance. And one other, I think, opportunity, particularly for the Bakken Museum, but perhaps for small and mid-sized museums and especially STEM museums, is to do more advocacy at the legislature. So that's something that we're taking on right now to, as a part of our, you know, vision for this abundant future where we're resourced and we're resourcing our staff in ways that value our time and what it takes to do this work, is to also really make the case at the legislative level to stay. This is a part of, you know, the ecosystem of what creates a vibrant, thriving community. And here's what it looks like to invest in that work at this museum. And this is what we're asking for. And we've been met with a lot of positive feedback so far as we've gone out to try to make that case. And I think that's something that we can really continue to deepen as we look towards the future.
I love that focus on the donor and funder education and understanding more about the workings of the museum, and also seeing the through line between being an institution that's growing human capacity and growing it within the staff itself that you're aligned around. So with just a few minutes left, I'd like to do another round robin to get all of your perspectives. People are, I hope, listening to this conversation to gain support and gain some new ideas for how they might approach these questions of equity, compensation, transformation at their own museums. So looking back on your time, whether it's been part of a year or it's been a few years with the Bakken and all of the efforts that you're making, what is one piece of advice you might offer a museum who, whether similar size or not, that knows they want to do some work in these areas? What would your recommendation be if I were to come to you and say, we really need some ideas to transform? What have you learned that you can share with us? Let's begin with Alyssa.
Sure. Well, again, I've been here 5 months, but what I have really witnessed and perhaps the nugget of advice that's just rising to the top is you're going to mess it up and just keep going. Keep going, dig in. We're setting the conditions from which to take really meaningful action and just keep at it. And I'm really inspired by how the Bakken Museum has practiced that in particular.
Great. Let's go to Alex for your thoughts on advice and opportunities that other museums could take from you.
Yeah, I'll try to keep this short. This is one thing I really wanted to plug during this conversation. but in our DEI theory of change, we have, I don't know if we're sharing this, I hope we do share it with the listeners, but we have a bunch of post-it notes throughout the different sections of that theory of change. And one of the post-it notes on our mid-range outcomes, it says, intentional inclusion of diverse perspectives in decision-making is a regular practice. And where that sticky note came from is recognizing that, you know, we have a diverse staff on staff, and it might not be fully diverse in terms of racial makeup, but there are other ways in which staff can be diverse. And, you know, part of that was being able to measure that. So like, let's actually survey, and, you know, how many of us identify as XYZ? And then how do you intentionally involve those diverse identities or connections to diverse identities when making decisions around making strategic decisions around equity? So, for example, I think it was last spring, we were getting ready and planning ahead towards June, which is known as Pride Month for the queer community. And the question was brought up, well, do we make our logo, you know, a rainbow logo this year? Do we do Pride theme somehow, something or other? And we use that as a really example moment of, well, let's include people who with that identity who are on staff in that discussion. And so we put together two structured conversations that people could opt into. You know, we have a smaller staff, but we have a diverse staff. So we had two conversations that folks could opt into, and what resulted from those conversations was a really robust critique of, you know, what are our internal practices for LGBTQ identified folks at the museum. And what came out of that was the call for a task force to be formed to really analyze our internal practices and make recommendations so that, you know, in the future, if we choose to publicly participate in some of this advocacy work, yeah, we know that we're comfortable with what we do at home. So maybe I'll leave it at that because we're almost out of time. But that's a really great example of, you know, let's harness the diverse perspectives that we have on staff, put them in places where they can have some power over decision making, and let's get some, you know, some real recommendations rolled out and implemented.
Fantastic model. And I love how you allowed that to grow, allowed that to go beyond the bounds of that initial conversation and gain momentum and transform the organization further. And another great example of openness to staff perspectives, which might sometimes challenge or push back. And you've spoken a little bit about that, Joe. So we'll go around to you for what advice you might offer a museum that is on the cusp of change.
Yeah, I think just to be brief, I think it builds off of something both Alyssa and Alex said. It's being less concerned with being perfect and being more concerned with how you're going to show up when you're not, and really focusing on like what's the, you know, if I go into a conversation about this Pride initiative, like the outcome may not be what I'm picturing the outcome is going to be. So like how do I respond to that in a way that's appropriate and moves the organization forward, and not what's the absolute thing that we have to do that is going to instead make us just be still and not move anything forward. So be willing to fail.
Willing to fail, and I love the phrase "show up." You are reminding me of the in Emergent Strategy, a book I recommend for everybody, and I'm sure you've looked at along your path. There's the saying "presence over prep." Meaning that you don't go in with, you know, this is the way it's always been done, these are the outcomes, but that you're present and able to participate in creating something that perhaps no one has yet imagined. So I want to thank you all today for being so candid and sharing so much of your practice at the Bakken Museum. You are really an exciting organization that I hope we'll see and hear lots more from. And I hope you continue to share what you're learning, what you're doing, and help this conversation move forward across our field. Thank you all. Alyssa, Alex, Joe, we all really appreciate hearing from you. And we wish you all the best of luck with your organization in the coming months and years as we sail on into the future. Well, thanks, everybody.
Thank you so much, Michelle.
Thank you.
Thanks, Joe and Alex.